Hi folks, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carl. Welcome you to the latest podcast from the Banter team. It's always good to speak to a legend, and they don't come more legendary than Nina Cherry. She was in Dublin a few weeks ago to speak to us at the National Gallery of Ireland as part of the Music Town Dublin Festival. It's an enthralling encounter with a diamond interviewee who had much to talk about regarding her life and work.
Hello.
Hi.
1-2-1-2.
One, two,
I thought you
three,
left
four.
Me. I was like, oh my God, don't leave me here on my own. Help.
I'll do the formal introductions. Good evening and welcome to the National Gallery of Ireland. My name is Jim Carroll. Would you please give a loud, warm, April Dublin even welcome to Nina Cherry.
Thank you.
Great to have you in Dublin again.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
And you're DJing later on at Wigwam, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to try. I'm going to play some tunes. I don't know if you call it DJing.
You DJ during the week, didn't you, or last week in London?
I played at a Patron tequila event, which is quite fun. And I played between 9 and 10, which was perfect. I was home by 11. So, very perfect sort of grandma DJing hours. It's quite good.
Let's start at the very, very start. Let's go back to the early days in Stockholm and your upbringing in Stockholm, your mother, your father, your stepfather. What do you remember most clearly about your early years? What's your first memories?
In my very early memories, I always remember a kind of closeness, and I always remember, of course, a lot of people being around. There was always music, and as much as my mother would like, and Don as well, would give me attention, they were always doing their own thing also creatively, so I was quite often just getting on with my own thing. I can't really remember the first place that we lived in Stockholm, but I guess I was about 3 or something, we moved into an apartment in the old town. And interestingly enough, or funnily enough, or whatever, the Modern Museum just opened an exhibition in Stockholm last weekend of my mother's work, because she was an artist. But a lot of it is actually focusing on this sort of era when Don, who's my stepfather, and Moki were working together in the sort of 60s and 70s. So there were a lot of pictures of that particular apartment that we lived in the old town. Yeah. And my mother, who her sort of creativity and her sort of attitude to her art was that it was encompassed by everything that she did. So, you know, our kitchen walls were painted blue with flames at the bottom. and all the walls in, because she went to study textile design. So sort of, I guess the patterns that she was working on also became the wallpaper. So I think that to me is when I think about my childhood, I feel very much that, I guess both me and Eagle Eye, my brother that I grew up with, we were very much the family unit was very much a part of everything that was going on. And in fact, the music that they were making at that time, they sort of started to call it the organic music theater. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I guess when I was little, you know, it was just the world that I lived in. Now, being where I am, I can kind of see it from another perspective and, of course, see that I kind of, in a way, apply a lot of that to my own life. Yeah. But those are the essence of the memories is very much about just the kind of the continuity of sound and color and music. But that also sounds kind of like more... It's just how it was. Do you know what I mean?
I'm assuming, yeah. The other thing as well, Nina, was that, like, I mean, your dad was from Sierra Leone originally. So did you spend time back there as a kid?
In Sierra Leone?
Yeah.
I didn't know that I had another father until I was six and a half or seven. So I met him when I was nine. So basically, up until then, my life was very much in the world of my mother and my stepfather, Dom. And we would live between Sweden and New York. And then I met my father at nine and sort of started to get to know him and would spend time with him on a regular basis and his family and my two siblings that he had after me. And which was great, but funnily enough, I kind of became closer to my brother and sister and to their mom than my father in the beginning. But he did a massive thing, because when I was 15, he hadn't been back to Africa for 10 years, to Sierra Leone, and he took me and my brother and sister, Tito and Cherno, and their mom to Sierra Leone, which was a huge trip, and it actually kind of changed my life. I more than just the thing of going to meet family and a route to who I am and where I come from, that I didn't really, it wasn't even the thing of not knowing it, but I couldn't kind of even imagine it, you know? But my mother kind of made me go. I really didn't want to go. I was scared shit. I was 15. We were in New York. I was going to CBGBs. And I think, you know, the night before I left, I went to see XTC or something and fell in love with one of the guys. And I was, like, obsessed. And I got on the plane wearing, you know, a Clash T-shirt, combat boots, kind of camouflage trousers. Arrived in Lagos, having stopped off in Copenhagen to meet my father and my brothers and sisters. And, you know, got off the plane in my Clash T-shirt, kind of just hanging on to what I thought I knew. And just, you know, Africa just took me. By the time I went home 6 months later, I had, like, you know, 42 plaits in my hair, and I was full African wardrobe. But he was really clever, because he took us first to Lagos for 2 weeks, and then we went to Ghana, and then nearly a month later, we arrived in Sierra Leone. And so we'd kind of acclimatized, you know, and we were kind of in the groove, and, you know, the spirit of Africa, I'll never forget kind of getting off the plane in Lagos, and there was just, like, you know, there were no conveyor belts for luggage, there were just kind of mountains of suitcases, and it was dark, and, you know, we got in we paid our way through the airport, you know, like, just bribed anyone we could, and this ended up in the back of this van, you know, in the dark of the night, and I'll never forget that humidity in the air and the spices and the, you know, mixed in with kind of sewer smells and feeling so incredibly far away from everything that I knew, but also knowing that I was meeting something really deep and fundamental.
Did you find then, when you went back to New York, I mean, you talked there about, like, you know, you were going to CBGB, CXTC, you were also, like, I mean, the apartment building you were living in Long Island City, the Talking Heads were there, were in the loft, one loft, Arthur Russell was in another. Did you find it when you went back to New York then, Nina, that Africa came back with you, and did it change your way of thinking?
Yeah, I think I kind of maybe left as a kind of teenager and as a child, and I think that I'd embraced womanhood in a weird sort of way when I came on that journey. And, I mean, I was still a kid. I mean, God, I'd look at pictures of myself like in Ripbrigham Panic, or just after I had my first daughter when I was 18, and, you know, I thought that I was quite a, you know, a big woman, and I just look at the picture, I'm like, fucking hell, you're just a little child. But I think that, you know, the women are very powerful in Africa. I was absolutely rolled over. So by the possibilities, you know, everywhere women kind of, you really see that women run society from the ground up, and the kids are with them everywhere. And, you know, it's, I mean, obviously there's a lot of other things that we could talk about politically and hardships, and but just the beauty of human resilience was very strong. So I guess that when I came back, the effect of that had, you know, had a really had made some changes. And then I kind of went back in where I'd left off, and you know, I'd been, I'm just trying to get the kind of dates right. But yeah, in my building was the Talking Heads and Arthur Russell, and he used to work upstairs, and the loft next to ours was Ernie Brooks, who was in the Modern Lovers, and then there was kind of our loft. And so there was just a building that kind of vibrated with sound and things doing stuff. And we used to kind of, everyone's doors were kind of open, so you could walk through from like my loft, you could pull open the fire escape, there was like a fire door, and you could walk into Ernie's loft, and then you could walk over into Jerry Harrison's loft on the other side. And so I guess having come back from Africa, I mean, that's when I kind of started to learn how to play the bass.
Who taught you how to play the bass?
No one, really. I wasn't a very good bass player. I mean, I guess I played, I think the first thing I learned on the bass was Iggy Pop, like, Now I Want to Be a Dog or something like that. I mean, that was the beauty of punk, I guess, was just that, you know, you just picked up whatever you fancied and, you know, played something, you know, made a sound. And then I guess, you know, my dad would show me things, or I'm, you know, yeah.
Like you said that when you arrived in London for the first time, then that you kind of felt like you'd met you were meeting your people for the first time.
Yeah.
There was a connection there. Did you find the kind of like the scene you were part of in London, that, like, I mean, the Slits, Ripbrigham and Panic, were they more open to what you were on about? Was it, did you find that, or did you just kind of find that you were a little bit wiser?
No, I mean, I don't think that I knew what I was actually on about, you know, at all. And I think that, I mean, I think that in a way, like, I grew up in an environment that was quite open. And, but at the same time, it was also quite I, in myself, at times would find it really awkward because, I mean, I am quite awkward, but I've come to accept that that's quite fine. And I quite, you know, I think most people struggle with with that, maybe. But I think that I was very conscious of never quite fitting in. And in Sweden, I was constantly trying to, you know, be Swedish or to fit in or to not be kind of singled out, you know, like my family, everyone looked different. My mom made you know, all of our clothes, and, you know, there were no black people in the community that I lived in, and in Sweden, in the countryside. And then we go to New York, and I'd kind of throw myself into black culture, or, you know, watching Soul Train, or buying, you know, you could go out and buy like Afro Sheen and Ultra Sheen, and, you know, listen to black radio, and like, but I was never really black, like, I'd hadn't, you know, like, we would live on the Lower East Side in kind of quite rough areas and whatever. But, you know, people would ask me, where are you from? And I'd go, I'm from Sweden. And they'd be like, what are you talking, you know, where is that? Is that where they make the cuckoo clock? It's like, what is that kind of thing? So I think when I came to London, it was just, it was the first time that I kind of ended up leaving home and going to London. That's when I left home. But also kind of like just finding my people. And I suppose the scene there was very kind of, they were just, you know, all sorts of people from different places doing, hanging out and making music. And I became really good friends with Ari from the Slits, the singer from the Slits, and she was like really deep into sound system culture, having come out of the sort of, I mean, she's really starting in the punk thing, but that's really where her head was at. So I ended up staying with her and her mum, Nora, who's married to John Lydon, who's a very special person. She's quite amazing, very eccentric. And, you know, Ari and I just kind of bonded and started literally like sharing our wardrobe and making photo albums together and, you know, and going to sound systems. So that was the other thing that I really, really, really went into deep in London. And Ari was one of the only, you know, women that actually stepped, that danced, that would go in the center. And there was one other girl, Barbara, that would do that. So it was like, to me, I guess that was as deep as kind of going to Africa in a way. That culture, it was something that I really hadn't. Obviously, there's a lot of, you know, West Indian people in the States and in New York, but I hadn't really gone into that dimension. And then, of course, there were lots of other things in London, and the guys from like Gareth and Sean and the guys who were from the pop group that were forming Rip Riggin Panic, kind of, and they were just crossing over in that era. They were, you know, I mean, there was a kind of freedom. Do you know what I mean? It was like people weren't sort of, I mean, so motivated by making money, or it was about expression. I guess it was also quite political, but there was also like a kind of, there weren't really any boundaries. And I think coming out of the punk thing, there was obviously a lot of the musicians and the kids or the people were discovering lots of other music, but there was no restriction in how you could apply it to your own thing. And yeah, so they were kind of really into jazz. So it was quite funny because that's the world I'd grown up in. But I didn't, I didn't really have any sense of that, you know, I hadn't discovered it myself. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. You spoke earlier on about like when you came back from Africa, you had this kind of regard for, you saw how strong women were there and you saw how they were holding things together. I'm always curious about this. Did you find that scene, that punk scene, that post-punk scene in London, was it feminist friendly?
Was it what?
Was it feminist friendly?
I mean, yes. I think, in a way, I feel really blessed because I've never felt restricted. I mean, in other places, sure, you know, but I've always thought, fuck it, I'm not, you know, and I guess it's become something that's motivated me rather than held me back. But I think that, I mean, I feel really blessed because I've always been surrounded by such brilliant thinking, inspiring women. And like one of my really great friends, Vivian Goldman, who's a writer, who I kind of met through my family, but who ended up being like a big part of my kind of foundation and a dear friend in London. She's still my really great friend. I mean, she was slightly like 10 years older than me, you know? And her friends really, you know, they were kind of schooled me in a lot of ways, because I think I was... and I still sometimes feel like that it's not that I blunder my way through things, but I don't always take the time and think about why exactly I'm doing things. I just sort of do them. So I think that was interesting. So I suppose in that section of my life, I think I was under the wing of and meeting a lot of women who were, you know, and definitely the women like Viv Albertine and Tessa Pollitt and people like that, who were a little bit older than me, were very, like, really influential. Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, that thing you just talked about there, it's sometimes you don't ask why. Do you think that's one of the reasons why you ended up as a pop star in the first place?
If it's what?
Do you think that's one of the reasons why you... I don't know. I promise you I speak
no,
slowly.
No, it's just, I'm actually a bit slow on the uptake. It's not you. I'm just a bit numb. I'm a numbskull.
But like, no. Yeah. That,
actually, you know what? Hold that.
Of course.
I'm going to take my jacket off. I'm quite warm. Let's go back to that.
Let's go back to that one.
I don't know if I really know the answer to that. Like, if that's, I mean, because I just think the whole concept of pop star, I don't know, like,
what I'm talking about. You're being coy here. It's like, you know what I'm talking about. Like that whole, the Buffalo Stance days, those days, that those years when people knew you for being like this pop star on Top of the Pops, 7-8 months pregnant, you were in the charts, you were part of that particular scene. Do you think you ended up there by accident?
Not completely, maybe. But I think we didn't really, and when I say we, Cameron, my husband, who was supposed to be here today, couldn't make it. He's just had an operation. Judy Blame, who I worked, you know, who I'm still working with, actually, kind of. I mean, there was a kind of family, a body of us that were kind of very much part of that, in that era. And I think we didn't really, you know, we didn't take all of that shit too seriously. So I think it kind of gave us access in a way. Like, we just kind of bombarded our way in with trainers and, you know, fake gold. And it was like, whatever. And we were just like, we're going to do this, you know, the way that we do it. And I think that in a way, you know, I think that maybe is what people found captivating or interesting. But that's not how we thought about it, because I don't think that that's really how you think about things when you're doing them or being creative. Or I think the minute that you start to sort of think, oh, I've got to do this, or I've got to achieve this, or I've got to sell this many fucking units, is when it becomes weird. And I think that I got to that after like my third album. I was just like, actually, this feels like a kind of a little jailhouse, because I can feel all this other stuff out there, and I'm not going to be able to do it in here worrying about, you know, how many radio plays I've had. It's like, I mean, that's, I'm not dissing that as a way of thinking or being. And I have like serious regard for people who are able to just keep churning it, but that just wasn't my destiny. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that in the time of Buffalo Stance and stuff, we were just kind of following our instincts, and we were quite cocky, and, you know, just not, I mean, it wasn't that I was unaffected by it, but I didn't want to be affected by it. Like, I kept going down to my corner shop in my slippers, because I just figured if the day I start feeling like I have to have full makeup before I can go out on my front door, I'm not interested. I can't, you know? So I think in a way, so we just, yeah, in a kind of delicate, bombastic way, we just turned out, you know, and it was, I think in a weird way, also the karma of, I mean, like, my kids are the best accidents that have happened to me, and my best creations, I guess, as well. But I mean, like, in a way, the karma of getting pregnant with Tyson totally when I wasn't, you know, it shouldn't really happen. And that moment of like being in with Ashley Newton, my A&R man, and kind of going, the album's nearly done and I've got something to tell you, I'm knocked up. And he was like, oh shit, what am I gonna do? You know, and I was like, it's gonna be fine. You know, I've already had a kid. I know that I can keep working. As long as she's fine or he, then there's no reason why we have to stop. But actually, it just became like the best thing that could have happened.
Your mother gave you some really good advice as well. I mean, she, like, you know, she just, maybe talk a little bit about that. I mean, she kind of said, just fire ahead.
Well, I think my mother had written this kind of, after she died, which was like 6 years ago or something. Now, we were looking through some of her, like, diaries or books. She always wrote a lot of stuff. And there was a thing that she'd written, like, I can't remember exactly how she said it, but it was something like, it was something about like how your home and your life is the stage and the stage is your home. And I think like when I got pregnant with Naima, she just said to me, don't separate yourself away from, you know, don't separate, you know, just let whatever you are doing be just in a kind of oneness. But of course, my mother would have said it much more eloquently, whatever she said, but it was something like that. But I think that really stuck with me. Like, and I guess that I grew up in that kind of environment. You know, like when my mom was still at school studying textiles, I mean, she used to take me in the basket as a baby and put me under her table while she was working. It's also, I suppose, a luxury in doing kind of in the sort of work that I do. I mean, it's harder, obviously, in some places. But I just, as much as I can, I've tried to keep that idea going. So, I mean, quite often I've been multitasking and writing songs whilst I'm cooking or doing something else. And like quite often when you listen back to cassettes where I'm like trying to capture ideas, I'm sort of talking to the kids or doing something else. And I think now I'm trying to actually, now that everyone's starting to grow up and do their own thing, learn how to just give myself proper time, because I do find that I am quite not dysfunctional creatively, but that I sometimes, I'll put myself last in the loop.
Do you find it kind of like that? It's when it comes to the creativity that you have to sort of like, I mean, like definitely put time aside for it, or do you kind of find that you can actually do it along with everything else? Do you find it's better when you actually have dedicated time to be creative?
I think that that's kind of what I'm trying to learn to get to be better at, is to be like continuously creative. I mean, I feel that I am continuously creative, because I feel that everything that I'm, I mean, being creative isn't just about writing, or, you know, it can just be what you think about when you're walking down the street, you know, and in a way that's when I think I am, that's where my ideas come from, you know? And then sitting down and executing them in my own space is where those influences have a chance to come out. But I think that I've worked within chaos for so long, you know, like, because there was always like a lot of people in my house. You know, at one point we were living in Spain and there was like a band called Whale there, Tricky was there, Martina was there, I was there working on a record, two kids, you know, and tons of other people. Plus, I guess I was like part of like feeding all of those people basically at the end of every day, and still managing to work, you know. And I think that has a kind of time span and a lifespan. Then I think that where I am now, I'm just trying to find, because the time's there. So now it's like being in that time and making the most of it, learning how to, you know, because everybody else right now, they're fine, touch wood. You know, all the kids, you know, it's like, so that's kind of been interesting. And I suppose making the last album, well, I mean, I didn't make a solo record. I was, you know, obviously always making music and stuff, but I didn't make a solo record for like 16 or 17 years, which wasn't really the plan. It just kind of ended up being like that. I don't, people are sort of always asking like, well, what happened to you? And it's like, well, I was just in my life,
yeah.
You know? But I got to a point where it was like, actually, it was Bono. So we were at something, I think they were in Paris, I think you two had played, and he said to me, I can feel the songs around your head. And I was like, shit, my God, he can feel it. It's like, because I think it just started to build up, and I got to a place where I kind of really needed to start to release whatever this build-up was. And I didn't quite know how to get there. Mm. And then, like, my mom died, and then I had a year of being completely kind of mad, nearly. And then it was just like, I realized that the only way that I could come through was to start writing. So I've always written a lot on my bed. I've always found that it's a very natural place for me. So I quite often just sit on my bed and write. And so I just went back to sitting on top of my bed, and that's kind of how that last record.
Yeah,
Blank Project.
Blank Project started happening, and then some of a few of those tracks also were on the record before, which was the Cherry Thing record. Yeah.
Before those records, I want to kind of bring it back to something you said there. You were talking about like the house you had in Spain, you know, and all those people coming in, you know, and as you're talking about feeding these people, I have this image of the Irish mammy, you know, bringing plates of food into all these people. But like, you know, you've always kind of lived as part of a collective. You mentioned earlier on about the organic theatre company that your mother and stepfather had, you know. Is collective living, is that sort of way of kind of living, is it good for working? Is it good for you as a kind of a songwriter or as a musician?
I mean, it definitely was. Now I kind of feel like I haven't got the fucking energy for it. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, get out of my house.
It's
just leave. But there was definitely a time when, you know, I mean, I think that without a doubt, after Raw Like Sushi, having Massive Attack kind of come into our life and hearing them writing their tunes and like literally Shara standing outside my bedroom door was really medicinal. And it was really, I think for both me and Cameron, it was like a really important process to kind of put, to give, to recycle back into something else that was coming to life. I mean, Massive Attack is very much that, you know, them, but we were part of a family, you know, and we're like kind of from the same grain. Yeah. And so I think that was a way of keeping things sane, and I think that way of sticking together and coming through, and then also with Porter's Head, who were also, you know, very much around. So, and it's also a way of not having to take your own thing too seriously, you know? So, but for sure, it was. I can so clearly see the links to my own childhood, because obviously, when I was growing up, there were always a lot of people around. I mean, it wasn't a commune, or you know, I get really annoyed when people are like, oh wow, you know, it was like hippie days, and it was all, you know, everyone was a bit out of it, and because I think that my family and a lot of their friends and the people around them were very committed to changing, you know, things. And that's really what they wanted to do. They were trying to create a world, you know, that the world that how they wanted to see it, or to at least plant the seeds. And it was a kind of an independence and a liberation, you know, and a fight against the sort of stereotypical societies. I mean, Don, my dad, of course came out of a very segregated, you know, hardcore place in the States where, you know, they really heavy stuff. I mean, my grandmother and my great-grandmother on that side of the family were maids and, you know, worked for white families, and my were in the Watts riots and, you know, heavy things. And of course, the music, the free jazz and bebop and that world was a very powerful, liberating, profound way of discovering freedom. But then, you know, once you put your instruments down and walked out the door, you know, you were still a black black woman or a black man or whatever, you know, looking at a pretty much an unchanged society for a long time. And I mean, it's still really messed up. So I think what I was trying to say was, then of course a lot of musicians and creative people ended up coming to Europe where things were kind of slightly different, and a lot of people stayed, you know. And my mother and Don tried to bring us back to live in the States. And we went to live in Vermont, like 69 to 70, I guess, where my dad was like a music professor at Dartmouth University. But they gave up, you know. They felt that, I guess, the Vietnam War was in full force, and they were being an interracial or mixed couple. They were like getting a lot of shit, and they wanted to break out. So they had this idea that they wanted to have, you know, a house where they could plant their own food and kind of have their own small-scale kind of universe. But I think I know I went into this rant because of that, so that kind of annoyance that I get when people just sort of go, oh, you know, they were just a bunch of hippies, because I think there was an amazing commitment and a kind of discipline in what they were doing. And, you know, when I look at, you know, my mother's creativity and my dad's and their peers, they were just with it all the time, you know, like just playing. I mean, it didn't stop, you know.
One person you've mentioned a few times, obviously, so far has been Cameron, you know. And, like, you know, you did a great quote about him. You said he was, when we interviewed for the Irish Times, you said he's my long, long, long time person of multitasking and work, life, babies, all of it. Can you remember the first time you met him?
Yes.
Do you know straight away he's going to be an important player in your life?
No. No, I kind of thought it was interesting, but actually when I first met him, I was like, I thought he was a bit of an asshole, like kind of. Or just a bit. He was like, he was wearing like a cowboy hat, you know, and he had his turn up. I was like, oh God, yeah, he thinks he's really cool, doesn't he? Because we were at Heathrow, and I was part of a like kind of group of people that were going to do on this kind of modeling thing for this designer called Takeo Kikuchi, who wanted to, you know, he started this a bit like Comme des Garçons do the same thing, where they would bring people, musicians, you know, kind of real people or whatever, to do these shows. And Ray Petrie, who was an amazing guy, but a stylist and a sort of creative art, fashion director, whatever, he had brought 10 or 12 of the Buffalo guys, and then me and another friend were part of this team of people. Anyway, so I went up to Cameron in the airport and said hi to him, and then I was like, he's very, very cool guy. And then about 3 or 4 days later was when we kind of found each other, and we had a funny connection because I knew his ex-wife and his son. So he has a son that's like 3 months apart from my daughter, Naima. They're actually brother and sister now. But I mean, as soon as we started to kind of talk and spend time, I think without a doubt that I just I mean, I think I can remember asking him, like, where have you been? You know, where yeah. I felt like I knew him and felt a kind of trust, or that I would keep getting to know him. I mean, I don't know that I feel that I completely know him, but then there's that fundamental thing which makes the connection, which was like very familiar. And I guess we've got an interesting thing because he can like really push my buttons and drive me nuts. But he kind of brings out something that no one else can, because he does also... I think I can be a bit random, or sometimes maybe I don't work hard enough at things, and he just has my bullshit detector down to a max, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't mince his words, which is can be really annoying. But it's that kind of companionship, I think, that, you know, it's incredibly valuable, right?
Yeah.
When somebody tells you what they don't want to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have, you know, we're lovers, we're married, but then we've got this other thing, which I don't know whether our love and all of it is mixed up in the work thing. I mean, to me, it feels like it's kind of separate, but it's also driven, obviously, by something in our connection. But yeah, it's a funny one.
But look, okay, so the one thing as well about, like, I mean, Cameron and you, I suppose, after the first three albums came out, I mean, you both started working with other acts as well. There's an awful lot of collaborations going on. Like, talk to me a little bit about that. How did you choose people? Did people come to you, or did you approach people about working with them on projects?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I think it's a funny thing doing a collaboration, because obviously, like, some of the collaborations over the years haven't worked, and there's, like, lots of stuff that no one's heard. Kind of collaborations, tried out ventures that no one, yeah, that I don't even know, they're on weird DAT tapes somewhere that don't exist anymore. But I think, I mean, to me, it's very much about a collaborative thing. I think that in the work, it's a very important part to the puzzle. And we, with Cameron and then with other people, there's always a kind of body of people around on the various projects that become family. And then you don't always carry the relationships on. And then I think just with certain people that I meet or come across, some people I just want to listen to them and kind of be in their company. And then with other people, you just sort of feel like, okay, I want to work with you. I mean, it's like with anything, isn't it? It's chemistry. It's about chemistry. And, you know, it can be quite scary, actually, when you've sort of said that you want to do something with someone. Then when you're actually there in the room about to do it and you don't know whether it's actually going to work or not, it's kind of petrifying. But
when it works, it does produce great work. And I'm thinking especially about the last two albums, you know, the Cherry Thing album with The Thing, and like especially Blank Project, when you worked with Rocket Number 9, Kieran Hebden, and the Child of Love. You know, I mean, I'm curious, does it take a long time for you to build up confidence to work with those people, or is the chemistry pretty instant?
No, I think, I mean, in these instances with the Cherry Thing and like working with Kieran and stuff, it was very much about not having time. And I think that has ended up being a really good thing, because I think after kind of not doing the kind of solo thing for ages, it was just about letting go in a way and kind of just jumping off the side of the building and kind of free falling for a little bit and then flying, not having, taking too much time to think, and, you know, not having the time to worry too much. So I think maybe the magic formula is then to have people around that you're working with that hold you, you know, where you feel like working with Kieran Hebden, he's kind of like a very free-thinking person, but he's also very specific, you know? And I think for me in Rocket Number 9, he was able to harness, you know? And we only had 5 days to make the album. And he wasn't in, and he's like, he knows when he has something, you know, and that's a good producer. When they're like, you don't need to re-sing that. And I'd be like, no, it sounds really crap. It's a bit out of tune. No, leave it. Because it was about the spirit and the vibe rather than perfection. And with the Cherry thing, that was the same kind of, you know, I mean, I think that it was really important to make that record first because it was very kind of primal, and it was very much about, I guess, my roots in music and where I come from in a way.
That was with the band, The Thing. They were doing like Don Cherry covers, weren't they?
Well, yeah, they're a trio. I mean, they have lots of other projects, but they're a trio. Two of them are Norwegian, one of them Swedish, and they're kind of like I think actually The Thing might have been one of my song titles of one of my dad's tunes, but they play kind of free jazz, but it's also really kind of punky, and they do actually a lot of covers of like you know, kind of heavy metal tunes even or whatever, and they've worked with Mats Gustafsson on the sax players, worked with Sonic Youth and, you know, Thurston Moore, and you know, so they've in that kind of, they play it like that, you know. So instantly, like when we got together and we'd sort of decided a few tunes that we were going to do, and we were only going to do cover versions because we didn't really have time to start writing. But it was also a kind of an interesting way to meet, and so we had quite a kind of a funny array of covers that we wanted to do. But it was just, we had like one afternoon where we did the first kind of half of the album nearly, and we just did one take of each song. We ended up just not going, re-recording anything really. And it was like remembering who I was. It was a trip. Mm. In fact, after we'd finished the session, I broke out in like a huge migraine because I think it was such a kind of, it was like all these toxins and kind of weird things that just got let out.
And did you find after the Cherry Thing album was released that, like, I mean, you were more in the mind frame then to do like Blank Project? Because I mean, the thing about the last album, Blank Project, is that it's a deeply personal piece of work. I mean, like, it comes after death of your mother. You're working that out. There's some amazing kind of like lines on the album when you're talking about, like, I mean, the black dog of depression. You're talking about, like, I mean, duvet days. You know, it's very much like, you know, Cherry writ large, that album.
Well, that's where I was coming out. What I was coming out from, you know, and I kind of realized, I guess, that the only way that I could move out and shift the kind of trauma, you know, that I ended, I was totally traumatized when my mom died. She died really suddenly, and we were really close, and it was like, and I just sent me into a place where I ended up literally where I like couldn't, I had a breakdown and I couldn't tie my shoes one day. I was just like, I have to go to hospital. It's like, I can't do this. And then, you know, so I put my hands up and I got help. And, but then there was the other bit, you know, you go to sort of, hospital and they give you all these tools and how to, you know, be in life and how to function, to be a functional human being and all that kind of stuff. And you sort of come out with all these things that I'd written down in my little book. But then it's like, you know, a few weeks in, it was just that thing, you know, deep inside, the dialogue that you can't really sit in a conversation and explain to someone, and I realized that the only way through it was through the songs and the lyrics. And I guess when I started writing Blank Project, I just tried to write in like a stream of consciousness. I think I've had a tendency sometimes or where I overthink things, and each song can be sometimes like a story or a little book that has a very specific beginning and an end. And with Blank Project, I just try to just ramble it out. Do you know what I mean? Almost like weird poetry or, you know, and a lot of the lyrics were written like that. Like I would just sit on the couch with a laptop and just write words sometimes with the music or a backing track going. And so I think it was like a weird exorcism, you know, like the stuff. And it was like medicinal. And I think that music and dance, that dialogue that I have with it, or with singing or performing, or that it releases things, you know, that I'm not very good at describing. I'm with them, but I don't, and I hold them, but it's like that thing of, yeah, you know?
Yeah, the way you described there as medicinal sounds really good, because, I mean, it allowed you to kind of, like, I suppose, clean the slate and, like, get all these kind of feelings out there. I'm curious as to, like, I mean, what the input was of Cameron was on all of that. Was he in terms of the Blank Project, was he kind of like in terms of, was he helping you with lyrics? Was he working on songs? Or was he just kind of, like, encouraging you?
Well, he's an amazing songwriter, and he's one of those people that has the ability to let things be and then also to kind of give them form when they need form. So he was really, I think it was very clear that I needed a lot of space to just open up and to not think about the structure and the form of songs, i.e. verse, chorus, verse, abdative, you know. I think that having said that, I always end up with a kind of pop sensibility in the songs, even trying to ignore that aspect. But Cam was great because he could just take my weird ramblings when they needed some structure and help that structure happen. And I suppose help just stop me from getting completely lost in my own woods, you know, like... So I think that's the thing that we have. It's like it's a way, like I'll sit in my own space and come up with lots of little things or sometimes full tunes. But then when I get together with Cam and we have another guy that we work with, Paul Sim, that's when it starts to take structure. But I think with Blank Project, it was sort of anti-structural in a way. Mm. And it was more about deconstruction and
To be like, you know, we're kind of coming to the close of the interview now. So there's one really curious thing I found out when I was just reading up in interviews. What's this about you and food broadcasting?
The what?
You and food programs, TV programs about food.
Oh, yeah.
tell us about this. How did that come about?
Oh God, I don't even really know. Like,
it's in the biog.
Yeah, me and my best friend Andrea Oliver did a 6-part thing for the BBC, and basically her brother was the bass player in Rip, Rig and Panic, and we were in Rip, Rig and Panic together. And then we sort of, when we first met, it was a big part of our friendship and dialogue has always been making food, you know, and so we just got someone. Found out somehow that we were thinking of maybe doing a cookbook. Then we got offered this TV thing and we did one series. But I actually found it a bit nauseating, TV.
Why? It's just very formatted?
Because it's very sort of, it's like, oh, and you have to, if you look at cooking programs, you know, they've got the bit of scribble at the beginning, and then it's a bit of narration, then it's a bit of just the way it's done. And actually, we wanted to do something completely different. So I just find, I just find it a bit, formula-ish, right. Too formula.
Right. If you were going to cook a meal for these great people here tonight, what would be on the menu?
Today?
Yeah.
don't know. Actually, a good thing to do for a lot of people is a feijoada, which is like a Brazilian stew with black beans, and you just chuck in lots of different meats. You can also make vegetarian ones, which is really good. But and then you have like sliced oranges on the side and rice, and then you make like a nice hot sauce with lime and chilies. So you have sliced oranges, and then you do this roasted yam flour thing, and you put it on top. It's really good with a caipirinha.
Okay,
then we'd be good friends.
I can hear my belly rumbling with that. Last question. I'm curious. There's a quote again from that Irish Times interview we did a couple of years ago. It was quote like, "I still feel unfinished and life feels unresolved. I still feel as awkward and weird and ridiculous as I did when I was a lot younger. When I was younger, you can be more cheeky, and I'm sure I was a bit of a twit." You have to do things rather than think about them. It's about execution rather than analysis. If you were to give advice to your daughter Mabel at the moment, who signed to Polydor, she's got a major record label and she's going through all that, would you give her advice, or what would you say to her?
Well, my dad always used to say to me, "Don't let them change you." And I guess the other thing I say to her now a lot is own it.
Own it.
Own it. And I think that is like very good advice. And because I think you're always going to be scared. You never kind of quite know like what's around the corner. But if you can kind of hold it and own it and be there, that's, you know?
That sounds good. That's a good way to wrap it. Nina Cherry, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, everyone.
Huge thanks to Nena for her insights and thoughts, and big thanks to Karen Walsh, Aoife Woodlock and all of Music Town, Luke O'Toole, Sinead Leahy and all of the National Gallery for their help with this event. This podcast was recorded by Brian Sinnott and was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news or up-to-date banter, plus you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We're taking a break for a few weeks, but we'll be back in July with more podcasts. Until then, goodbye and take care.